Where did you meet the devotees to come here? In the village here?
No,
in
the trade center.
Oh, the trade center. Do you work down there? You must have seen, you're new working there, but we've been there for the trade center for a long time. Working there a long time? World Trade Center? You?
No, passing through.
Oh, you're just passing through?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. I see. And you got a book to read? You must have. When you were going to the World Trade Center?
You gave me one.
And we're going to read a little bit from Bhagavad Gita.
You've come.
And that was sure? Never? You look
like
your we spoke. What's your name?
Dan.
You're familiar with Bhagavad Gita, right?
Yeah.
A little bit? Or you've read it through?
Not all of it.
I'm going to read this evening from the 12th chapter. Maybe you can pass out copies. What I'd like to do is give a summary, kind of summary, of the chapter. In this chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's entitled Devotional Service. There are one way to describe the entire text of Bhagavad Gita is to say that it's a this presentation of all the different yoga systems, originally. First, Krishna is the original yogi, original teacher of all yoga systems. And there are many different varieties of yoga practice. However, they can be divided into four basic categories. And just to put it in the English context, there is a yoga, a general category of yoga practice that deals with working activity. That's karma yoga. There's a type of yoga, a general category of yoga practice that deals with philosophical inquiry, trying to reach the supreme by intense intellectual endeavor. That's called jnana yoga. There's another yoga system, general category, that deals with meditation, concentration of the mind to attain realization of the supreme. And that general category is called dhyana yoga, meditational yoga. And the fourth is what this chapter deals with, devotional yoga. Those who try to reach the supreme by their love and devotion for the Supreme. So, you don't have the advantage of reading the previous 11 chapters, and it does go in a sequence, one chapter following, for a very particular reason, following the preceding chapter. So, this 12th chapter is right after revealing of the universal form. Familiar with what the universal form is? If you look at the cover of the bottom of the print, there's a picture of Krishna who is in the foreground, the bluish form, and Arjuna who's reaching for his arrow. So just prior to a major battle that was about to take place 5,000 years ago, this Bhagavad Gita discussion, dialogue, place. And one of the main persons to take part in the fighting was Arjuna, the one reaching his arrows. Before he decided he wanted to go ahead with this, he fighting. In various ways, he was asking Krishna what was the best thing for him to do. In the course of their dialogue, Arjuna, the warrior, asked Krishna to please allow him to see the whole of the material creation of one face at one time. He requested Krishna, like, if you deem me qualified, please give me the divine eyes to see this form of yours. And so Krishna reciprocated that request and displayed his universal form, which showed thousands of arms and legs and faces and mouths and bodies, and all assembled in all directions simultaneously. The whole of the universe, the whole of all the residents of the higher planets and the hellish planets and all the different species of everything, all simultaneously at once. The description is given of that universal form. And after the conclusion of seeing the universal form, Arjuna is completely overwhelmed and prays to that same Krishna who is still standing beside him, please remove this form. This form is too frightened. So please allow me again to see your original form. I'll feel much better then. And then when Krishna assumes his original form again, Arjuna offers very nice prayers, acknowledging that Krishna is not just a good friend or an ordinary person, and he makes apologies all over the place for his seeing Krishna in any kind of ordinary way, and acknowledges his position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that this is not just my idea. All the previous sages and saintly persons, they have also, and he lists others who have, through their performance of yoga practice, have come to the same conclusion. So that's the preliminary before this chapter begins. Now, Arjuna, you look at the beginning of the chapter. Arjuna is asking, of all the different systems of yoga, there are two prominent features that are realized. One is the impersonal feature, the unmanifested, or personal form, which is realized by devotional service, which is the best path to follow, which is the better of the two. Between serving God directly or the path that leads one to appreciate his all-pervasive spiritual force or presence. And then text 2, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, those who fix their minds on my personal form are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith, are considered to be the most perfect. But those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, unchanging, fixed and immovable, the impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth, by controlling various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons engaged in the welfare of all at last achieve me. So, both processes ultimately end up at the same conclusion. However, the impersonal process, you can see, if it ends up at the same conclusion, however you go through it in a circuitous way, you go through all kinds of difficulty to reach that conclusion. Eventually reaching the same conclusion, then it's indirect method, therefore it's not the best, it's not the recommended thing. If you want to go from New York to Boston, if that's what you desire, to go from here to Boston, then you could go to Mexico and Hawaii, and that might be very nice. And then and travel through the east. But there's more direct ways of doing it. Go straight. So now this is a very serious question that Arjuna is asking, because a lot of people ask it also in their own way. Poets and philosophers, theologians have been asking the same question since time immemorial. All the different activities that I can do, or that one can do, to advance the spiritual life, which is the most recommended thing for me to do? Because there are so many different choices to make. Materially it's true, and also spiritually it's true. Here, Krishna in the next verse gives an explanation of why one is preferred and the other is less preferred, or less desirable. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifest and impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. So I want to jump ahead a little bit in the chapter. The reason that advancement in the impersonal path is difficult for those who are embodied is because we're accustomed to relating to this world through this body. Spirit soul is within the body. And the body is a covering over the spirit soul. And through the openings of this body, through the various coverings of the body, we're able to perceive. The consciousness of the soul reaches into the external world through our vision and smelling, and tasting, and touch. Well, those are just instruments. This body in that way is just an instrument to deal with the external material energy. But the body itself is not the conscious energy. It's simply a vehicle. So, while we're embodied, we're accustomed to experiencing our consciousness through this body. So, to come to that point where consciousness can be experienced unembodied is very difficult. Or as it says here, very, very troublesome. Progress in the discipline of the impersonal, formless, colorless, qualityless, shapeless, activityless spirit. That's not within our experience. In fact, not only is it not within our experience, we can't even imagine it with our power of the mind to even, or to speak of, to know with our intelligence, with our mind, is inconceivable. Even if you develop your mind to the point where it can just extend to great, great lengths of imagination or conceptualization, the mind cannot accommodate that which lies beyond the mind. The senses cannot perceive that which lies beyond the senses. So it's very difficult. You have to call upon another faculty altogether than the normal faculties of consciousness that we're accustomed to working with in an embodied state. Goes on, but those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, it doesn't say giving up activity, but rather rendering all activity, yielding all the fruits of your activity to God, and being devoted to me without deviation, engaged in devotional service and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Pritha, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. That means the consciousness that accompanies what's being described here, that consciousness of devotion, carries one beyond the embodied state. In other words, there's no separate endeavor that's required to become free from that which we're accustomed to working to become free from this body. You automatically become free from the body by devotion to that which is beyond the body. Or just as the soul is situated beyond the material elements that it sits with, God also. So it's the spiritual entity or spirit soul relating directly with loving and caring devotion to God, who is also beyond the field of the material energy. Immediately the connection is made. In fact, that's what the meaning of yoga is. Connecting or linking. One energy linking with the higher energy. That's here to translate yoga. Looking it up in the Sanskrit dictionary. It means connecting or linking up. Performing some other yoga system, they have to take great pain and trouble to detach themselves from this body. You know that Indian man, the sannyasi, the yogi, that's been staying at the temple? He got a little scruffy beard, short, wearing sannyas garb.
He's
not there right now. There's one yogi who's been staying at our temple off and on. And he's just started he's 30 and he's not sure he may do a 60-day fast. He's a week into it. And his motivation is, he has some mystic power, this man. He has some power. His idea is he wants to perform this extended fast just for the benefit of New York City. There's some kind of special power that comes from performing austerities. And of course, in his case, how he wants to apply that special power is by giving some benediction or benefit to others. However, it's only with a lot of difficulty, and only to the end of for his own consciousness becoming detached from the body. Obviously, if you just don't put any food in the body, you become a little bit detached from it. Take your automobile, just don't put any gasoline in it, don't put any oil in it, don't use it, just sits there. After some time, start to care a whole lot less about that car than you did when you were depending upon it every day to get you around. He's just, your body, when you're fasting, your body becomes a little bit weakened, at least initially. And the scope of your activity has to be adjusted accordingly. But for the yogi, their interest is something different. They're not just looking for bodily strength and how they're attracting another person, how beautiful their body looks. So they become very appealing to another individual. Their interest is altogether a different interest. Something more subtle, something that's completely apart from the body. You become detached from the body. In that state of being detached from the body, your identification shifts altogether. It's not that you lose any sense of being. It's just another identity begins to become clearer. And that other identity is the soul, separate from that body that you're now detached from. Just like your shirt. You may have a favorite shirt that you wear. life or something. But when the shirt rips or wears out or something, you throw it away, you may be a little disparaged for a while. Anyway, that doesn't last for long because it's not who you are. The covering of the soul is not a real identity anyway. So there are different avenues to go about detaching yourself from that covering, this body, this who we aren't. So this method is very much like just saying, I'm not this, I'm not the body, I'm not the covering, I'm not the garment, I'm not the... And just not paying any attention to it, not even dealing with it, not even putting food in it, not even exercising it. Just letting it go. Detached. That's very difficult. And it's not even natural. Because the body's existence is a reality. Although it's temporary only, nonetheless, it's here. So, because the body is here, there are different ways. What was being outlined in the chapter here is another way altogether than just denying the body, of parching the elements of the body. Another way to become detached from the body is by understanding in a higher way what the soul is, what the soul's real identity in relation to the Supreme is. So that's what Krishna is describing. So a point that I wanted to jump ahead on is towards the end of this chapter, Krishna starts to describe, beginning with text 14, it's at the bottom of 627. Krishna starts to describe different mentalities that are very pleasing to him. In other words, the quality of the consciousness of a transcendentalist is to be presented. One who is not envious but is a kind friend to all living entities. Who does not think himself a proprietor and is free from false ego. Bottom of 627. I'm sorry, top of 628. Translation. Start again. One who is not envious, but as a kind friend to all living entities, who does not think himself a proprietor, and is free from false ego, who is equal in both happiness and distress, who is tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled, and engaged in devotional service with determination, his mind and intelligence fixed on him, such a devotee of mine is very dear to me. And again, he for whom no one is put into difficulty, and who is not disturbed by anyone, who is equal poised in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety, is very dear to me. My devotee who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, who is pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, and not striving for some result, is very dear to me. One who neither rejoices nor grieves, who neither laments nor desires, and who renounces both auspicious and inauspicious things, such a devotee is very dear to me. One who is equal to friends and enemies, who is equipoised in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, fame and infamy, who is always free from contaminating association, always silent and satisfied with anything, who doesn't care for any residence, who is fixed in knowledge, and who is engaged in emotional service, such a person is very dear to me. Those who follow this imperishable path of devotional service and who completely engage themselves with faith, making me the Supreme Goal, they're very, very dear to me. One of the requirements in the devotional path for achieving the actual, achieving what the goal is mentally, is achieving some empowerment. Just like I was describing, the yogi who, by performing different yogic practices and austerities, they become very powerful to the point where they can defy the laws of nature by their will. The material laws become subservient. An ordinary person cannot do that. It requires some special energy or power or quality. So just as that is the product of yogi, so the devotee achieves a similar kind of conclusion, defying the normal course of material laws, but for a different, coming from a different position. And this different position is achieving the favor of God. When one becomes very dear, even if they're in material activity, when one becomes very dear to another person, then the person who one is very dear to will extend themselves in all kinds of ways to provide for the comfort or well-being and satisfy the desires of that person who is very, very endeared. It's a natural thing even we find here. So what to speak of when one has that attitude in relation to God? That natural reciprocation is there. One who, by their consciousness, is non-envious, very loving and affectionate, and displays that in relation to other entities, in relation to God Himself, in relation to their dealings with material energy, they're not hankering for something material to possess and become the proprietor of, as is described. They're not hankering for some particular result in terms of their material activity. They're not even claiming that that result belongs to them, but rather it belongs to God. If they're put into some situation of difficulty, that isn't any better or worse than a situation where some very favorable thing seems to be about to happen. It'll become depressed in one case and elated in another case. In other words, that detachment, the same as we were describing a little bit earlier, that same detachment also follows. One, you can only become transcendental to influence of the material forces of material nature if there's some other special higher principle at work on the soul or on consciousness. In the case of devotional service, that higher principle is the upliftment that comes from the favor of God, the mercy of God. When God sees a living entity endeavoring in that way to direct their every effort and energy and activity in a very loving way in relation to Him, then the impinging forces of the material energy subside. Those things that are unwanted in anyone's life, those influences stop. That's simply a matter of consciousness. It's not that the material energy stops its movement. The transcendentalist can go anywhere and remain undisturbed. Whereas materialistic person can be in the same place and become very disturbed. Material energy doesn't stop doing its thing. But rather the harassment, the difficulty that the living entity is put into stops. That's the position of the transcendentalist. Therefore, the transcendentalist doesn't have to be simply in a mountain cave, say, mendicant. Wearing only loincloth and becoming haggardly because of paying no attention to the body. That's one kind of detachment. But if one is, so to speak, attached to living in that way, then that's another attachment. In a broader sense, of transcendentalism can be in that situation or can be in completely the opposite of that situation and still remain undisturbed. Not just in rags, but also in riches. Not just in honor, but also in dishonor. Not just in privacy, but also in the midst of millions. So the person, anyone who is endeavoring to try to develop their spiritual understanding, or their, even better, trying to develop their spiritual consciousness, needs to know the right procedure to accomplish that. So the question that Arjuna is asking at the beginning of the chapter is very, very relevant for anyone that's trying to advance their life in a spiritual way. Therefore, it's very practical. Yoga method. Because this particular yoga method does not require that someone make radical change in the externals of their life. Before you lost your book, did you get a chance to read any part of it?
No, I didn't.
Right away you lost it. Which book did you receive? How did you happen to remember to come here?
I didn't lose
the card. Oh, you did lose the card. Have you done any kind of meditation? Or just following this description?
Biofeedback.
When you were taking up biofeedback, what were you hoping to accomplish? For relaxation. What was the... Was there some degree of spiritual dimension there also? And you like that? Would it make sense to you if detachment was there while emotion was also there? And what does your mother do?
I think she had that, you know, feeling that when I was meditating, that the time I woke up was emotional.
I see. Well, that's in terms of no emotion, in terms of that which is temporary.
Yeah.
But what about emotion? In terms of that which is not temporary. Emotion for that which is not temporary means the soul or God. Follow the point that I'm making? Yes. We have to have it because it's natural for the soul. In fact, emotion is natural for the soul. But emotion in terms of that which is, in terms of the body, or anything that's temporary, possessions, money, bank balance, stock market, whatever, some temporary pleasure, or on even the other side, temporary stress, pain. One, at least as far as these verses that we've been reading, the transcendentalist doesn't have to worry about those things. The detached yogi is ambivalent. But that doesn't mean ambivalent for those things that are temporary only. As far as those things that are eternal, then there's great concern. Like the example that you just gave. What about the soul of the world? Soul, not the body. Because when the body, if the body were to die, will the soul also die? The soul would not die. That's the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita. At the time that the body wears out, ceases to function properly. The same is not true of the soul. The soul is eternal. By definition, the soul is eternal. So the soul lives beyond the body. Therefore, it's very, very elementary discussion that goes on at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. In this dialogue, Krishna is telling Arjuna, do not lament for the body. The wise person does not lament for the body. Neither the living in any situation of life, nor of dying. The wise person does not lament. Why? Because they understand that the soul is imperishable. The soul is never born, because the soul is eternal. And the soul never dies, because the soul is eternal. The soul may go from one body, leave his body, and take up the residence in another body. Just like you may take residence in the set of clothes that you're wearing today, and discard them, and tomorrow take on another set of clothes. Is that a cause for lamentation? Of course not. We don't lament over that. I mean, I guess some crazy people might lament over something like that, but normally people don't lament over those kinds of external temporary changes of covering. So also the body is just a temporary cover of the soul. The soul doesn't perish with the body. Undergoes its changes. So there's no cause to lament when you have proper knowledge. The soul is eternal. But then you can have very nice feeling about the soul and the soul's relationship with the Supreme. That's what the verse is describing. That's in a nutshell how the chapter begins. Arjuna wants to know, what's the best way to reach that point all the time? Detachment from matter and attachment to spirit. You said you had that experience when you were practicing karate?
Biofeedback.
Anything comparable to that from your practice of martial arts, you said? No?
You found most of control practice of martial arts.
Say it again?
You found most of control
or self control.
Right.
When you say self control, you mean just like control of your limbs?
Yeah,
or you mean also
control
emotions also? With a real expert martial artist want to see that their emotions stop or be controlled? Why would they want any emotion? Why would they want to just control it? Why wouldn't they want to eliminate their emotion?
Well, listen to them.
So, just to echo what you're saying, the transcendentalist, what Krishna's this presentation here says the same, but a little bit different. Emotion is part of life. But for the transcendentalist, that emotion, they don't care for that emotion. Or they see that that emotion is foreign, not who we really are, not a real identity, having nothing to do with our eternal existence, unless that emotion is in terms of that which is eternal. Oh God. That's where the adjective devotional comes from. Devotion means feeling. So feeling for that which is divine. Feeling for that which is permanent. Full of truth. Feeling for that which is full of truth and full of eternality. And feeling for that which is full of spiritual happiness. Happiness that doesn't perish, it doesn't come and then subside, pass away. Great feeling for the eternal realm. Now I have another question. Could you conceive, and I don't know what your occupation is, but could you conceive of carrying about, going about your regular working day in that kind of consciousness? Well, what these little verses we just read indicate, and the rest of Bhagavad Gita as well, is that one's occupation one does not need to give up in order to experience that consciousness. Or, if one, say, conversely, if one is experiencing that consciousness, it isn't a necessary fact that now you have to give up your external activities. Your activity has to now change because you have a particular spiritual consciousness. Case in point is that a warrior, Arjuna, who's, as the cover indicates, he's reaching for his arrows, is about to fight in a big battle in devotional service to Krishna. I don't know if you've ever been in a fight before, but imagine being in a fight and being in devotional consciousness at the same time. That's probably even more intense than going to work every day and being in devotional consciousness. Nonetheless, the advice is being given to Arjuna, because you are a warrior. That is your nature. You're a warrior because that's your nature. Therefore, you're obliged. If you don't fight in this circumstance, your fighting propensity will come out. Anyway, or saying it applied to your situation, you have a particular job, maybe because it's just part of surviving in the world the way it is today, but also because you have a particular psychological and physical nature. You're doing the kind of work that you're doing rather than being a professional boxer or whatever, because you have a particular nature. Therefore, you're doing work that's at least somewhat remotely akin to your nature. And you're obliged to do those things that are according to your nature anyway. You can't repress them. They're going to come out somehow. But the caution is, at least, how one can do that and be a transcendentalist at the same time is by detaching yourself from those activities that are simply of the body or born of the material nature, influences of the material energy, upon this bag, this body. Rather, utilize those energies that are born of material nature, but at the same time have the proper consciousness, so that you can understand that which is supreme, while going about doing what is natural for this body to do. Cultivating and developing spiritual consciousness, God consciousness. So my point is to repeat an earlier point. My point was, that's only... transcendental consciousness all the time. In reciprocation for your devotion. Just like if you were a very wealthy person. Supposing you were just a fabulously filthy rich man. And you had a very good friend who you could sense just from being with this person that he wasn't your friend just because you're like super wealthy, unlike many other people who may come forward to you simply because they're interested in what they're going to get from you, but another person was just genuinely your friend. It's very easy to see how that person would have everything that they need. They would be provided for no problem by a very wealthy person. No problem. No financial problem for that second individual, for your friend. So in the same manner, one who becomes, in a very natural way, non-envious way, devoted to God, those harassments that other individuals may experience at the hands of the material energy, will be freed from them, freed from those problems, the problems of material life. Because those who become very dear to God receive His mercy. Does that make sense to you? That's real friendship. That's a real friendship. So my point is, we should become like that in relation to God. Because aside from monetary wealth, God has all riches, all strength, all fame, all beauty, all renunciation. One who becomes dear to such a person benefits from those very same qualities. And conversely, those that don't have that kind of relationship with the source of all strength, all beauty, all wealth, all knowledge, all renunciation, they're in a less fortunate situation, or more destitute, more impoverished of spiritual quality. If you want to make it, in a nutshell, if you want to make advancement in the spiritual path, the very simple answer that's being presented in this chapter is, make yourself very devoted to God. Rather than trying to approach in some mechanical way, try to understand who God is and devote yourself to He who is God. Immediately then you're beyond the laws of material nature. That doesn't mean your body will not become old. But you no longer experience the pangs of old age. And as the soul leaves the body, at the time when the body is finished, you simply your consciousness, that spiritual consciousness or divine consciousness carries you to God. In this lifetime, free from unnecessary tribulation. Unnecessary tribulation. And after the body is finished, that same consciousness can continue. If you become so detached from the body like that, then you will actually no longer require one. The soul can then exist simply in relation to God. The spiritual solution is not that you have to give up this world now, give up all your worldly belongings, quit your job, have nothing to do with your friends and family, become like a madman wandering around the street somewhere with no home. That's not the definition of spiritual. Although it may seem to be difficult to go through your working day in transcendental consciousness, it's more difficult to try to go through your day without it. And it's even more difficult to try to just kick it out because you have a particular nature. You want to act in a particular way anyways. It's not that there's no way out. It's not that there is no such thing as spiritual life or transcendental life. Transcendental life is, given the constraints that this body imposes upon us, the limitations of consciousness that we have. I cannot see all the different colors of light. I cannot hear all the types of sound vibration. I can't hear my senses are limited. This body is limited. I'm subject to old age. I'm subject to diseases. Ultimately subject to death. Even given all those things, one's consciousness can be completely detached from them by devotion to God. So then, once that's understood, what remains is then to understand who is God, so I can fix my consciousness upon God. And that's what these literatures are meant to bring the reader to the point of. And that's what this association of devotees is meant also to establish in a very simple way. Not a change. It's revolutionary, but we're not interested in taking over the government or kicking this leader or that leader out. Leaders will come and go anyway, just by course of time and modes of material nature. The man who's popular today will be fiend tomorrow. One who is sometimes honored by nature of duality later on will be dishonored. Man who is today dishonored will tomorrow be honored. Revolutionary. We're interested in revolutionary way, changing consciousness. We don't mind if the World Trade Towers stay where they are. I mean, of course, if time someone's going to knock them down like they do every other building in New York. Some amount of time, every building that goes up also comes down. We don't have to worry about it. We are interested in consciousness. The consciousness of the people who walk through that place. The rest of the city and on the face of the planet. Situated within this kind of body or that kind of body or this many years old or younger. It doesn't matter. Consciousness is the liberation. Presenting an alternative. Chapters that are what? Have you practiced any kind of yoga yourself? Yes. Then it sounds like you're disciplined. Person.
I think I could always be more disciplined.
Devotional also?
Yeah.
You know the difference between the different systems of yoga? I mean, in some practical way?
I'm sure there's probably a few that I haven't heard of.
Would you consider yourself to be a devotional? Following a devotional path, or no?
Well, I do natural healing work. I consider that part of the devotional path.
What about your sadhana, your practices that you do?
I do some asanas, and I do some chanting, and some pranayama.
Do this just on your own? Just like in the ashram, in the temple, there are those that live that way all the time. Supposing you were in the company of those that live that way all the time, you would do it all the time. Maybe that tells you something.
Well, I don't consider the path of the people that are at the ashram very easy to have.
But the devotional.
Yeah. I consider they're getting a lot out of it.
you had some further opportunity, just like you participated in cooking at the rainbow gathering on occasion at the temple. Supposing, as part of sadhana, you did that on some kind of regular basis, rather than sparse here or there.
Are you suggesting something?
I'm suggesting that if you see that there's something that's beneficial, devotionally beneficial, why not apply that to something in a regular way? Just like you do chanting. Would you? There was probably a time when you know, now and then when you felt like it, you would chant a little bit, and you do a little pranayama, a little exercise here and there. But somewhere along the line, you understood it was good for you to do that on a regular basis. If it's good for you to do it on an occasional basis, far more to do it on a regular basis. I'm sure you experienced the benefit of that in many ways. So I'm suggesting the same. Some direct devotional service to Krishna is very uplifting for the heart. It is about another vibration altogether, as you said. A little tiger down by the food intestines, or a devotional eater. The foodstuffs are of the quality of the person who prepares it. One of the principles that we follow, we're vegetarians, as you know. But we don't eat grains that are cooked by anyone other than a devotee. And the reason is, consciousness, in fact, karma, is transmitted through that food. You can take on another person's wicked mind through food that you eat. Food is such an important thing. Consciousness is such an important thing. Consciousness is imparted from one person to another in many ways. And food is one of them. Sound vibration is another one. So your response may be, I'm not ready for a commitment, but you're certainly ready for a spiritual...
I just don't know if I can live in the ashram. I feel like that's a little thing to do right now. I don't know.
That's not a thing that I'm directly suggesting either. I'm suggesting that those things that you do understand to be spiritually beneficial...
partake of them.
Yeah. Some regulated manner, some disciplined manner. Even if it's just simply from the position that I understand that it's good for me, therefore I'll do it. Even sometimes I may not feel like doing it, I'll do it. Just like I'm sure there are times when you don't feel like performing your sadhana, but you do it. At least if you have that kind of discipline, then that frees you from the modes of material nature. More. Frees you from duality. Being pushed and pulled by the material energy. So we can discuss something maybe something that you can handle that's very simple and practical. Regulate. That's the motion. Do you have any question or comment over this? Taking all this in?
I'm taking all in. I start to have comments.
Can you relate to it?
Right.
Whoa.
like to take the good from
it. You feel that there's some good.
There's some good. So I'm open to the good that will come. A lot of
some things that you're not so comfortable with also.
Well, it's just basic. You know, to me, it's just philosophical. Give and take. Open to many interpretations.
What about the practical?
If it's better for me, then it's certainly worthwhile.
Well,
a lot of different
things. If I understand if something is better for you, then it really certainly helps a lot to understand who you are. Well, I'm suggesting that, yeah. Everyone has some self-identity. So, you can take things from one extreme all the way over to the other extreme. They're completely, people are completely, at least clinically, batty. When that's body is that you. Yeah, and there are extremes of that also. This city's filled with people that are walking up and down the street, picking up one identity and dropping it, creating another one, and talking to themselves and trying to figure out who they are.
I feel pretty confident myself.
So that, aside from that's the far, you know, far out extreme. But at least the conclusion about the Gita, right from the very beginning, the insertion about is that even someone who has a great deal of self-control may also be an illusion, not knowing who they are. If, in that case is when someone gets the soul as their real identity.
That would be arrogance.
What do you mean? Explain.
Well, if someone has a great deal of self-control, but still an illusion, that person would be
pretender.
Misled about, say, his confidence in his day-to-day
right.
life.
Bluff.
So, yeah, the arrogance. I don't think I've learned.
Well, I don't know you one iota, so I certainly can't say who you are, or I can't say who you are, but I don't know. The descriptions that are being presented the end of the chapters. In other words, there are some standards of quality by which a self-realized soul can be known. Those qualities are read over. Someone who is in fact no longer an illusion, no longer misidentifying with that which they are not. And one essential ingredient in that these standard qualities include a very clear understanding of the soul's relation to God, the parts relation to the whole. If you hear cars moving on the street, you have these cushions. You hear the cushions rather than hear these voices. Perhaps somebody close to speak playing musical instruments. So those sounds cannot be separated from the source of the sounds. You can try to analyze the quality of that sound, or you can try to analyze light, say a sunbeam. But your understanding of that sunbeam would be incomplete without also understanding the sun. But that beam is being emanated from. You can have it all down as far as the energy, but you also have to understand the energetic source. That's so using that comparison. comparison, in a similar way, self-knowledge must also include very clear body of knowledge of God. As clear as well as you can understand yourself. You're self-realized to the extent you are also God realized. That description is given in the Bhagavad-gita. Sometimes people ask that question. Remember, once Prabhupada was asked that question. Which comes first? Self-realization or God-realization? And his answer was, it happens simultaneously. The analogy he gave was that as the sun rises, you have a mirror in front of your face, you cannot see your face again. It's dark. But as the sun rises, or you have one of those variable resistor things that turns the light on gradually, and that to the extent that there is light, you can see your own reflection. As there is illumination, you can see yourself. Illumination is from God. Sure. If there's God, there's also the capacity, at least, on God's side of things, for some individual to also become enlightened. True. Well, the whole process of yoga is to discover, not because someone says so, but to discover in fact whether or not that's true, whether there is truth. In other words, again, the definition of the word yoga is linking up.
Well, if someone who practices yoga to attain that mindset, or if someone say, it's faced with a terrible tragedy in their life, it occurs, and then through that, they discover.
Yeah, that's not a very convincing thing, because it takes a tragedy to bring something.
Truth is truth.
Yes. But, so, supposing after some time passes, the calamity has faded away, and if that, as you gave quotes to, that truth also fades.
Well, that gives you the person.
Yes, that's up to the person. But if that truth also fades, then it's not a very convincing thing.
Obviously, they're not, at that point, they weren't ready to take it in.
So, scripture is that which is truth that doesn't fade away, whether it's brought about by some calamity or not. that which isn't eroded by time, isn't brought into being by some event of material nature. In other words, it is existing primordial before creation and after annihilation. According to at least,
I mean, it sounds very, it's pretty traditional.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard the path and everything. 90% of the things that I've heard are very Christian in origin. Just like maybe in the same thing as Jews or Muslims. We all kind of agree. All of these religions basically get down to the truth. The ones that deal with the deities.
Are you vegetarian?
I'm working on it. It's not really cooking cheese. And that was an example I was going to do. I've been there too. Through that, I feel like I've definitely, you know, given that meat pretty much. It's fading out. And I feel better about it.
Today's Ekadasi. Normally, on Ekadasi days, we fast from beans, grains, just eat other lighter foods. So, folks put together something great. Vegetable mix in that you. Because the self is part of God. And you can look at it from both sides. From the individual soul's point of view looking towards God, or from God's point of view looking towards the soul.
How would someone who...
Can you understand your finger separate from the body? If you're understanding, or conversely, if you understand the body, aren't you also understanding your finger? You can understand the whole, can you also simultaneously understand the part of the whole?
Yeah.
They occur at the same time.
Well, for example, somebody who...
they progress simultaneously.
Understands that they're not this body. How did that necessarily be?
How would that what?
How would that help you to advance to the point of understanding that they're separated part and parcel of God?
They won't necessarily. It'll help in that they've overcome one hurdle. The hurdle of gross illusion.
Yeah.
However, they may think, what a relief. And not progress any further.
That was like,
you're pretty steady back there.
I've been coming here daily for several weeks now.
It's a long haul to climb up all these stairs just to get up here, too.
Well, that is possible.
No?
I'm very fortunate because I had a stress cardiogram about 5 years ago. I'm 67 now. When I was 62, I had a stress cardiogram, and the doctor told me my heart was acting like that of a 34-year-old person.
And you've been vegetarian for some time also?
Yes.
How long?
About 20 years.
Okay, there you go. They say, medical scientists say, that cardiovascular diseases is the number one cause of death.
And I don't have any arguments with any vegetarian.
Oh. Well, I'm not saying you'll argue back. I'm not saying it's okay.
No, I agree. It's certainly better.